You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and before we start this episode, my solo stand-up tour, Compared to What, is coming to Manchester, Dublin, Exeter, Bath, Harrogate, Birmingham, Hull, Shrewsbury or Shrewsbury, depending on how medieval you are, Bristol, Glasgow, Newcastle, Darlington and Leeds, before, in the middle of March, going to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival for a month. If you're in any of those places, go to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out how you can come along, and you can ask me questions about the podcast afterwards and we can meet up and have a roaring good time. The show has been going down really well. I've been so enjoying the run. I had a beautiful show last night in Crawley and I'm on my way to Brighton tonight. So also, if you're not in any of those places or they're too far away from you, then do check the website anyway, because when I get back from Melbourne towards the end of April, there is another 15 or 16 dates in there, including a week at the Soho Theatre in London. That's the tour blurb. This is the episode. I've been sitting on this episode with the brilliant Mark Forward, an excellent Canadian comic who I saw at Edinburgh, I think 2 years ago now, and his stuff is on Spotify. You can find his gear online. He reminds me a little bit, not in terms of his actual act, but in terms of how different he is, the different approach he takes to a lot of other comedians. He reminds me of like a Canadian Boothby Graffo. So if you're a fan of Boothby, you should definitely check this episode out. I recorded this in his hotel room as we both drank a small amount of red wine at the Montreal Comedy Festival, the Just for Laughs Festival, last year. So this is the brilliant Mark Forward.
How many times have you been to Montreal?
Are we recording right now?
Yeah, we are.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
How many times have you been to the festival?
This is my seventh.
Okay.
Yeah. This is my seventh time.
And are you... Okay. Oh, in fact, before we start, we are recording, but before we properly start, mm-hmm. and we may leave this in, yeah. I've only seen you live once. And
okay.
I try to see people as often as possible. I have your album on Spotify.
Okay.
Which I made available for... non-internet access mode.
Okay.
So I actually physically took it from Spotify.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
One of the first things I noticed about you when I was researching you was I found an interview in which you were talking about having quit comedy.
Yeah.
So give us a bit of a timeline for who you are and what you're doing in comedy.
All right. Well, hi, my name's Mark Forward. that happened in 2010. When I retired from comedy, what it actually was a very angry, disillusioned, upset human being at the jobs I was taking and why I was taking them. So it was also a time during comedy when, you know, Dane Cook was at his height, and I hated how much attention he was getting, and people like Louis C.K. were not at their height, and I was like, why are we? So it was around that time too. In that article I do talk about those things, so I'm a bit of a psychic that I saw that the world was going to shift. But so in Canada, I don't know what it's like everywhere else, but in Canada they don't care about Canadians. We're like, we don't get press, we don't get anything. So I was about, I don't know, that might have been what? So that would have been about 10 years in. I started saying on Twitter that this is my last year being a comedian. I didn't know there was a reporter that followed me on Twitter. And he said, would you like to do a story on it? You can write it. I'll pay you. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. The first article I'm ever going to get in Canada is the one about me leaving the business. Oh, and I was like, I have to do that. I have to. So I wrote this article. It was just me venting at frustration. I was doing gigs in arena, like small town arenas for hockey fundraisers and all these things that weren't comedy to me. They were, I didn't want to be hired entertainment. I wanted to be a good comedian. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so I wrote this article. I mean, at the end of the article, I say, like, I have a gig in 2 weeks. Like, but what I really was retiring from was doing comedy to make money. And I never took a gig after that article that I didn't want to do, whatever the price was. So I retired from all that, and now I'm doing shows I want to do and the kind of comedy I want to do. I don't want to do as anybody from out of town. I don't want to do, I don't want to pick on the local mayor in the crowd. I don't enjoy that. So I retired from that. Now the flack I took from comics was huge.
For having appeared to retire and then
appeared
not
to retire and
that
not
aspect of it.
Yeah. How could you? You know, we're just all working hard. How dare you? Blah, blah, blah.
Because you'd kind of put your head above the parapet and said, actually, there's a lot of shit in comedy. There's a lot of stuff I don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, so I took a lot of flack from it. A lot. Still, guys egg me about that. Here's the best thing. That year, I did Craig Ferguson, The Late Late Show. I got on a sitcom here in Canada. I mean, I had the best... I had the best year, so they could talk all they want.
Yeah,
because I was just like, "Wow."
Do you think any of them were thinking, "Oh, that's the secret"? What
that's
you have
the
to
secret.
Do is publicly quit.
It could have been that some of them were angry. Like he did this as a stunt, and now he's getting recognition for it. But it was something more at the time. I didn't know as much as I know about it now. If that makes sense. But it was definitely a cleanse of some sort.
And what? Were you, because I imagine there'll be lots of comics listening to this who
will there be?
Yeah, there will.
Won't they just skip through? Won't they just look at the list of names and go, I don't know that one?
Some of them will, but the ones who have any goddamn integrity at all eventually reach a point where they go back and listen to all of them.
All right.
That's a podcaster talking there. Where I think some comics, a lot of new comics and a lot of wannabe comics.
All right.
So let's just talk from the point of view of how did you end up in a position where, like, why had you made the decisions in the first place to take the money gigs?
I thought you were supposed to. I thought you were supposed to take every gig you were offered. I think comedy's a weird thing because you start off. I think your first, I want to say 5 years. You're doing it all wrong. You're doing, for me, I could be wrong, but I think you're doing it for everyone else. You're doing it to impress the guys at the back of the room. You're doing it to try and be like someone you idolized. You're doing it, because you think, oh, I can't make money elsewhere. You're doing it for all these weird reasons that I didn't like. And so I looked at the money I was making and I said, can I live without that amount of money if I walk away from those certain gigs? And I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. I've done it before. I just want to do the gigs where I don't want to say artistic, but I...
You're allowed to say artistic. If that's what you mean, you're allowed to say that here.
I don't know. I'm like... I'm one of those people that, like, I believe in the art form, but I don't want to ever say it's my passion. Like, you know what I mean? I want to be down the middle somehow. But
why is that? Because what does it mean to you when someone says it's their passion? What turns you off?
Well, it turns me off when people say, like, I couldn't do anything else. That's when I go, okay, come on. Let's, you know, comedy could die tomorrow and you'd be okay. you'd find something else to do. You might not enjoy it as much, but you know, the ones that are like, I have to do this and I can't do anything else. Come on.
Okay.
That's insulting to the human race.
Okay.
It's something you really love doing and you do it because you can. That's as far as I'll take it.
So just moving up to this, the point where you went enough.
Yeah.
Just take us back for people listening to this who don't know you. How mm-hmm. did you start initially? What was your road into comedy?
My road was, I started as a theater actor. I went to theater school. I hated it with a passion. There's that passion word again. Hatred is easy to have.
Why did you hate it? What did you hate about it?
I didn't like the pretentiousness. I didn't like the false. There's a lot of false people there. And they all had delusions of grandeur, and they all were going to be the next something. And I was more like, I don't know if I want to do this. Let's try it. So I never really fit in with the, you know, they'd be like, oh, I can't wait till we do this play. It's going to be so great. And I'm going to get so deep into the character. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, I'll give it a go. The vibe was off. And then I graduated, and then I worked professionally in a horrible theater. It was at lunch. It was at noon. Business people would come down the elevator, eat their lunch in the theater, and watch a play, and then go back to work.
Okay. I've not really heard of that before. Is that a thing in Canada?
It's not a thing anywhere, I don't believe. Okay. I don't even think that theater's there anymore. The funny thing was that I was working in the same building at night. So I was working in the bank, taking business deposits that came in from the day and opening them up, putting them in people's accounts from 2 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Okay.
Then go and put a play on at noon, then rehearse for the next play, and then go to bed. So I didn't like that either. And then Canada opened a comedy school. It was kind of credible, and now it's not really anymore.
Okay.
But a former teacher of mine said, you should go do that. And I was like, well, I'll give it a go. And I liked it. I liked it. It was a weird way to get into stand-up, but I liked it.
When you say it was a weird way, is that because it doesn't seem to fit the more usual template of the burning desire to do something?
Totally. Well, it was also shit on relentlessly by the guys that had been doing it 15, 20 years, right? And this is, as I get, they would be threatened by that. Like, oh, you think you can just go to a school and learn this?
Which a reasonable answer might be, yeah, it's a skill.
Yeah, it's a skill. And if someone's funny, you can teach them better ways to write, to learn. The other thing, too, is like this school taught you, you know, script writing and improv and you know, other things you wouldn't be, clown and all these things that stand-ups are so afraid of, but now I'm using in my act. So I never understood, why wouldn't you just be a well-rounded performer? It doesn't hurt you as a stand-up. No one's going to...
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the pain of doing all the road miles is such that if someone comes along who doesn't appear to have done all the road miles or who has learned as much as you in half the time,
yeah,
you could see how, I guess, for like a road act, that would be...
Yes.
Just what you mean? It was a waste of time. That last 100,000 miles I needn't have done.
Yeah, I could see how it would be that, but and I mean, it wasn't great. All it was a little bit of a jump start to me. It just put you in the right place. It put you with people that were like minded, and then I found out, you know, where to go, where to do it, how to do it. It took a bit of the fear away, rather than walking into an amateur night for the first time. Without anything would be terrifying, and I get that they would be like, you should do that, you piece of garbage. But yeah, so I did that for a year, and then I was just out there doing it.
And what was the relationship between the stuff you learned in a kind of safe environment,
mm-hmm.
and like at you know, if you're writing jokes in the comedy class,
mm-hmm.
did that, were you writing then the sort of stuff that you wanted in the end to give up, or were you writing the purer stuff that then got corrupted by the circuit?
That's a great point. I was already getting corrupted in that school away from where I wanted to go. Because I was being taught by an old stand-up that kind of quashed me where I wanted to head the first day. So, yeah. I think, like I was saying, the first 5 years, like, you're doing it for everything else other than yourself. And then also, you get hit hard that first, like, you know what I mean? Like, you're either told you're ripping off someone, or you're this, or you're that, or everyone's against you.
Yeah. You're ripping off someone you've never heard of or seen. Yeah, some incredibly obscure act for 20 years ago.
And you go home hating yourself, like, well, what did I do? And like, how could you not know so-and-so has a joke like that, or blah, blah, blah. It's like, what?
I think that's just a side note there. I think that's one of the worst habits of comedy reviewers, to effectively show off how much they know about comedy by suggesting that a newer act is, well, I mean, of course, we all saw Emo do this 30 years ago. And you go, well, that new act has not seen that.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, like, music's cyclical?
I think cyclical.
Cyclical, right? So we don't get angry at music coming back or bands. Like, we don't go, oh, well, that's just, you're just ripping off the Stones there, but like,
we do a little bit, don't we? Do we?
Do we? I don't know enough about music. I shouldn't have chosen.
No, I don't either. This is going to be the blind leading the blind if we go.
I shouldn't have chosen music as an example. Yeah, maybe you're right.
But there are certain.
Do you know what I'm learning in the last couple of years is to stop and think, and then go, yeah, you know what? Maybe you're right. It's a good thing to learn, right?
Oh, man. I tell you what. My relationship with my brother has improved immeasurably since I learnt the sentence, I apologize and respectfully withdraw. It's such a big deal to him in a way that I completely understand but never noticed.
Yeah.
If I, as his older brother, just go, oh, yeah, I was totally wrong. Thinking about that, I was wrong. Sorry. You just go, boom, wow.
I bet you it lights up his soul.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely something I learned. Especially when you do these interviews and you just hear yourself and you're like, you know what, shut up for a second and really think about what you're saying and then go, no, I'm wrong on that one.
But I think we were talking about influences or echoes of things. Like in a lot of other art forms, it's perfectly acceptable to have to be influenced by something.
Yes.
And I think in stand-up, people are very keen because the pool of potential influence is so small compared to music. There are so comparatively few stand-up comedians in the world that have ever been.
Oh, yeah.
That it's almost a thrill
for someone. But you can notice it in, like, even in cities with amateur nights, how, you know, like, the when you start out, you're kind of echoing, like, a headliner in that town that you've admired or worked with a lot.
Because you think that's what comedy is.
Yes. And then, you know, and then hopefully, here's where I think there's a split. This is where you go successful to just a, I don't want to say club comic, but like just a, you know the guys I'm saying.
Yeah. Patton Oswalt has a lovely phrase, funny, but who gives a fuck?
Yeah. 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 So some split and go the hard route and some just stay that topical, everyday, easy route.
Run of the mill.
Yeah, yeah. And I was heading down that route, as I think everyone does. You know, everyone has their first 5 minutes of poop and their first 5 minutes about, you know what I mean? Yeah, everyone has their shit joke and their. And I was heading down that road and then I saw John Doerr one night. Do you know John Doerr?
I don't know John Doerr.
He's a Canadian and now he's in the States. He's a really out there, anyone listening, if you haven't seen John Doerr, look up his appearance on Conan. He's doing stand-up. The usher is making too much noise in the crowd, and he asks them to keep it down, and the usher's like, well, actually, but I'm just doing my job. And he's a stand-up act. He's like, well, I'm trying to do a more important job up here. And the usher's like, oh, you think your job's more important? John's like, oh, you think this is easy? And the usher's like, yeah, I think it's easy. And then they swap. And the usher starts doing the stand-up, and John starts being the usher. And they get into a yelling match. Oh, I'm ushering now. I'm ushering now. And he's like, boo, 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 I'm telling jokes. And then Conan's like, whoa, 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 guys. And it's this whole elaborate thing. And Conan's like, guys, guys. And then John's like, do you think this is easy, Conan? And Conan's like, yeah, I think it's easy. So then Conan's ushering, Andy's doing the stand-up. The usher is now the guest. John's at the desk.
Amazing.
It's this whole thing. So when I first saw him at a club in Toronto, it wasn't a huge thing like that. I just saw him. He left the stage, sat in the audience, and did a set towards the stage like he was an audience member and he was watching the comic. And his whole set was from there. And I was sitting in the back of the room going, well, he can't do that. And then having an argument in my head where the other side of my head was like, well, why can't he do it, Mark? And I was like, yeah, why can't he do that? And then after that, I was like, I'm not doing anything I don't want to do anymore. And it was just a real eye-opening moment of like, you can do whatever you want up there. You don't have to do what you think you have to do. And so, I mean, I that might not have been a great story, but
hey, know what I'm saying.
No, I
that was a great story.
I put myself down.
This is a good point.
Fall down at the end there.
Hey, buddy, you're doing fine.
So this is Mark. I'm really enjoying talking to him. I hope, from what I remember, we didn't get drunk. We just got slightly merry. And there's a chance that some parts of the show are a little bit rambly. Apologies for those. And also, congratulations for getting to listen to those, because I'm sure they were as fun. I mean, I hope they are as fun to listen to as they were to record. Mark is a lovely, lovely man. Very, very funny. A brilliant off-the-wall sense of humour. And I do enjoy seeing comics sometimes when... Sometimes it's fun to see a comic and think, I should have got to that joke first. Like, oh, that's so annoying. That's a great bit. That's a great observation. I didn't get there in time. They beat me to it. Sometimes it's fun to see comics and think, I could never have got there. And I think Mark is one of those. So do check out his stuff online. I've got a couple of bits of correspondence to read out. This is from Kieran, who saw my show in Poole. Kieran says, while at work on Friday, I got a text from my partner saying she was working Saturday night, so couldn't come with me to the gig after all. And I wondered aloud whether I could get away with going on my own. At which point, two colleagues said they would come, and the three men sitting in front of me were friends and family of those women. I hadn't met them before. This meant five people were at your show purely on my recommendation, which was more responsibility than I'd anticipated. So thank you, he goes on to say, for being brilliant. Ah, thanks, Kieran. He says, an excellent time was had by all, and they were very effusive in their praise afterwards, so you may well have gained five fans. I'm very glad to hear it, Kieran. Nicola says, hi, Stu. I hope you and the Boutros are well. We are well, thank you. I'm two episodes off becoming a completist. Good Lord, really? After I started listening last April. That is hardcore. She says, I started cherry picking, but now just listen to all of them, and it's introduced me to so much comedy. I've got tickets to see you in Glasgow and I can't wait. Now, this is interesting. She said, I bought them before I'd heard any of your albums and was a bit nervous because through the podcast, I feel I know you as an interviewer and a bit as a person, but not as a comic. This is a common problem, Nicola. She says, however, I listened to Princess Uncle Stew and An Hour and was laughing to myself on the bus like a lunatic. I don't know how one... I mean, we can all visualise that. This is more than I would spend on a bottle of wine. This is an accompanying message for a very kind donation. More than I would spend on a bottle of wine or a new baby gift, but I just had to support the podcast because I love the great work you do, and I loved getting my name read out on a previous podcast. Other podcasts exist? What nonsense is this? She says, see you in March, Nicola. P.S. I'm not a cool guy, and I would like a couple of sentences in reply. Here are my sentences, Nicola. Wow, bit pushy, mate. thank you for getting in touch. Thank you again for your donation. And thanks for taking a chance on the show, particularly if you hadn't heard... Thanks for taking a chance at the stand-up show, particularly if you hadn't heard any of my stand-up beforehand. I'm glad you enjoyed those albums, which are, of course, still available from comedianscomedian.com/shop. Princess Uncle Stew is free, and Extra Life and An Hour you now have to pay a small amount for. So thank you to both of you guys. A quick shout-out to Bryony, who's coming to Harrogate. Rich says her name is Bryony, and she is very nice. I'm sure you'll like her, too. This is someone that's being dragged along to the show, but I need to reassure her that she's going to have a good time. Listen, I'm five shows in now, and into a sort of ultimately about a 50 or 60 date tour. I'm having so much fun. I'll tell you more about it in the post-amble. But suffice to say, if you're thinking of taking a chance on the show, please do get along to comedianscomedian.com/tour and make it happen. And then come and meet me afterwards. Great chatting to Ben White last night after the show and some other people as well whose names temporarily escaped me. But it's really fun meeting you all, and I'm really enjoying the tour. If you'd like to donate to this show, as my dear friend and mysterious benefactor, Thelma, did recently. Thank you so much, Thelma. That's really kind of you. And not for the first time. Genuinely very much appreciate it. Other people, Tracy has donated a very worthy sum in the last few days. Winston has donated as well, as has Colm. I'm not going to list everybody, but I really appreciate your donations. Dave as well. Thank you, Dave. Very kind. They really do. They're the only way this show makes money, apart from the two or three episodes. Was it four episodes in 200 that have carried a tiny advert? So if you like the show, if you want it to continue, there's never been a better or more pressing time to go to comedianscomedian.com/donate and organise perhaps a recurring payment of maybe £2 a month, or indeed a one-off payment of as much as you would like to pay. That's all of that. I won't bang on about the tour anymore. I might talk about it retrospectively in the post-amble, but for now, let's get back to the wonderful Mark Forward.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
It's really hard for me because I'll be halfway through a story and I'm like, no one fucking cares, Mark, and I'll have to push.
What, in your life or in your act?
In my head, constantly. Dude, look at see those two glasses of wine right there?
Yeah.
Those are my first two nights. I went down to the party. I bought a glass of wine, tried to be a regular human, and then I left. And then that's the second one.
Doing the same thing.
That's as far as I've gone. Maybe a sip.
From trying to be a regular human.
Trying to be a regular human. Yeah. So this is really hard.
Well,
the fact that I'm even saying words. It's really hard.
We will get to all this. Let's get to it now, because the regular human response to what it's like downstairs is to take your drink and go the fuck to your room.
Yeah.
So you are being a very regular human.
I'm being regular human.
You are
being?
Absolutely being a regular
okay.
human. What's down there is an absolute vortex of schmooze.
Yes.
And that's fun. Yeah. And I enjoy it because I feel like I've got so little at stake here. I'm bouncing around meeting people. It's
right.
fine, you know.
Right.
I can only do that for so long before I go, this is awful.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know. We barely met, but I'm like, I really love you, man. And you don't need to feel bad for bringing your wine up to your room.
I do. And the thing is, though, then I don't even finish it up here by myself. I'm like, why am I still hurting? Just drink the glass, put on something. No, it's twice. I'm going to try. My goal is to come up with an empty glass one night and put it beside those two soldiers.
That's nice. I mean, you don't need to, if it's empty, you don't need to.
Yeah, I don't need to bring the glass
but
up.
But
maybe symbolizing for me.
Please tweet the soldiers at the end, at the end of the festival.
Yeah, yeah. Last night I didn't even make it. I didn't even make it to the bar. Yeah. It was pretty crazy in there last night, but I was there with a friend and we were walking and then if I had made it right to the front of the bar and got the drink, I might have stayed for a bit, but I couldn't, we were behind people.
Yeah.
And the guy was like hugging this girl and like kissing her, and then he grabbed her ass and she pulled his hand up, and then I was like, I gotta go. I was out. It was weird. And if you do see me down there, I will be off alone at a table, almost orbiting it like a Pluto.
Why is that?
I think it's two things. I think there are really probably really interesting people to talk to down there. They're hard to find amongst the other clutter, right? Like, you could go to a garbage dump and find treasure.
Yeah.
But you're going to find a lot of dirty, shitty diapers and
yeah,
and stuff. And I always seem to end up getting stuck in the corner talking to the shitty diapers rather than the people just want to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Like, if your response to how are you is shows are going great, you know, I talked, it's like, then I'm like, no, but how are you? Like,
yeah.
How are you?
But that does enable, but what, here's what I do.
Yeah.
I think I'm better at doing this now. I'm very new to this. It's only my second Montreal, but I've been to the Edinburgh Festival for many, many, many years.
Which is massive.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And people do this thing. We call it shouldering in Edinburgh, where you're talking to someone and
they're looking over your shoulder.
More exciting, famous, or important to their potential career is over the shoulder.
Yeah.
So what I now do is, if I say to someone, how you doing? And they go, oh, smashed it last night, really took the roof off the thing. They don't mind if you go, great, and walk away.
Yes.
They don't mind because they got what they wanted. And so it's actually useful for us because what they're doing is they're flagging up. I'm in this mode now. I'm not condemning people to that thing. And God knows, I'm sure I've done it myself. But if they're in that mode at the time, then that allows you to go, good for you.
Yeah,
and go away. And then when you say to someone, how are you doing? And they go, yeah. Oh, you're like, ah, oh, now let's have a sit down, shall we?
Yeah, I like that. Like that.
Do you feel since the schism, since the change,
mm-hmm.
Since your comedy menopause, and the comedy puberty is what it is. It's yeah. The birth of the real stuff.
Yeah.
Do you feel more free? Did it work? Do you feel happier with your work?
Yeah, 100% happier with my work. I like what I'm doing. I really like what I'm doing.
Because what you're doing for people, and this is quite late in the conversation to be bringing this up, but as you say, people won't recognize you.
No, they don't care. They're not listening.
What you do is really, it's great, man. I love your act, what I've seen of it. I saw you in Edinburgh. Okay, right, this is a whole other subset. I saw, I believe, the one gig that you did in Edinburgh last year that you hated.
Right.
Does this ring any bells? Because I really appreciated the stuff you were doing.
Oh.
But you had a horrible time. You told us every 5 or 6 minutes what a horrible time you were having. And I came out, I was like, oh, wow. I mean, I sort of get that he's doing this really weird outre kind of, like, you know, sort of stuff. He didn't enjoy that at all. How did Edinburgh go generally last year for you?
I really loved it. I really did. Overall, I really loved it. It was great. And I remember someone telling me about halfway through, you're just going to want to cry. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. What are you talking about? Come on. This is great. And yeah, it was about August 17th, 18th. It was just sitting in the flat going, why am I so down? Like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
I think there, the weird thing is, the up and down is so constant. Like, the up and down of emotion, the up and down of the ride, the up and down of, fuck, is anybody coming tonight? Okay, they are coming. Okay, good. So that part's done. Now I'll worry about the show, and then the show, and then, oh, shit. And the other thing, too, is you're told exactly who's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Reviewers are coming. I'm like, what? Reviewers don't come in Canada? Like, no one gives it. Crap if it's good or not, so there was this up and down but halfway through I was like, oh.
Last year for me was a revolution because I only cried on one day in the middle. Yeah, I can't, what the fuck am I doing? And I had a really enjoyable time last year. I had a really good show. I had a really positive festival. And part of the way I can tell it was festival was I really only had one day, roughly in the middle, where I was in pieces.
Yeah. It's weird, right?
It's totally weird. It's totally exhausting. But so we got onto this because I was asking about the type of stuff you do.
Yeah.
So I never like to, I do this all the time, but I never like to say to people, So what kind of comedian is the worst thing? So let me tell you what I think you do, and you tell me if it's
that'd be great, because I don't have an answer.
Okay, so I think what you do is kind of it's observational comedy, but it's daft and it's kind of off the wall, and on stage you're really kind of charming and humble, and then angry, and then charming and humble again. And you are, I think, are known for, what's a real characteristic of your act, is you do profoundly long act outs that then turn into kind of mini plays, which are kind of Shaggy Dog stories, in that the joy of them is the journey, not the destination.
Correct.
Hey, that's that right? Okay, that's good.
I'm going to transcribe that when I...
When I should offer it out as a service. What kind of comedian are you? Wait there.
Yeah, press play.
Yeah.
No, that was pretty bang on. That was great.
Your opening line on the Craig Ferguson clip that's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Where you walk out. Do you remember exactly what the words? Because I'll butcher it.
I'm pretty sure it's thanks, I'm pretty good. Or I usually say something along that line.
You say, I think you said, thanks, I'm good.
Yeah.
And then you pause and you go, I'm one of the best. Completely won over by that, because it's so this kind of humble arrogance. They're so attracted to it. I love it.
Yeah.
When did you start saying that? Let's just.
I think that was the first. That was the first time I started doing it, and now I pretty much start every set like that now.
For the TV taping.
Every TV tape. Yeah, well, yeah. For the Ferguson. Yeah.
So as you're walking up to the mic, you thought of it or what?
I don't know. I really don't know the origin of that one, but I knew technically why it helped me. Do you know what I mean? Like, technically as a comedian, I knew that exactly doing that lets them know exactly who I am with only a couple words.
Yes.
And then I can get away with who I want to be.
So when you say exactly who I am, put it in your words, who are you? Or what is it about that sentence?
It kind of gives you that feel of, okay, well, this guy's tongue in cheek. He's not on the level in any way. Puts them kind of on alert, if is a good term.
You're going to have to pay attention to this.
Yeah, you're going to have to pay attention to this. I don't know if that was real or not. I don't know. Why would he... Okay, that kind of feeling of, and then there's the other group of people that go, oh, that's just funny. And those people would have been on board anyway.
Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I always wanted something that just automatically told the room within a couple words of, this is what you're about to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, I berate my crowds. And I have people that love that, but I don't do it. It's not malicious. Like, I don't even know how to explain it. But it was a trick I learned in high school. One time, I told one of the guys I hated more than life what a dick he was, and he laughed. And I was like, oh, this is an interesting... sort of superpower.
Like, I just told the unvarnished truth unafraid.
And he laughed at the idea that...
Do you remember what you said to him?
I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but I just remember, like, just saying it, and he laughed, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. And then throughout high school, I would just be more saying shit to people, and they would laugh, and I'm like...
There's some
truth in what I'm saying.
Yeah. Is it so? Okay. So that's like the idea of, if you can say something that's true.
Yeah.
That isn't like a concealed truth. If you can put your finger on, I'm just kind of trying to put the mindset of teenage you. If you can say something that is unexpectedly honest.
Yeah.
Then it's funny.
Yeah. It was a weird sort of realization. Like, I can tell, like, people that come to see me, I can tell them that you guys are a bag of garbage bunch of people, and they will go,
no, your stuff, you've got the material on the album about What's the name of the album? Just what we're
Things I Thought Of.
Things I Thought Of by Mark Ford, and it's on Spotify.
Yes.
And presumably, can we buy it from your website rather than give Spotify?
I think you can buy it on iTunes. I don't know.
So there is a bit of material you do about the people, the fact that people's dogs don't love them.
Yes.
And it's lovely. It's a really delicious bit of material because it's so clearly holding up that sacred cow of, but my, and your characterization of the, but no, dog, my dog loves me. Yeah. It's really sweet.
Oh,
and I suppose
you.
That's a similar sort of angle of attack, isn't it?
Yes. That's something yeah, it's exactly that. It's like, hey, don't, but okay, you're right, but hey, stop it, but yeah, you're right.
and that, so if the first inkling of that was at college?
That was in high school.
In high school.
Yeah, that was in high school, and then just throughout stand-up, just doing it and realizing, hey, I can get away with stuff that some couldn't.
Okay. And then taking that idea of getting away with things to your current stand-up.
Yeah.
Something I really enjoyed in your work is that you...
Do you know it's rare to talk to someone, interview you, that has investigated your work?
Oh, well, good.
It's very nice.
Good, because I fucking love the podcast, and I need an edge.
I just want to compliment you.
Oh, thank you.
You're doing a good job.
Thanks, man.
To the point, I'm like, is this actually being recorded?
Yeah, we're going to pull back the cameras. No one really cares, Mark. I'm having this all fed to me.
Yeah, you son of a bitch.
By your former agent.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you bring out old ex-girlfriends and they...
I was going to say, yes, you're really good at holding the line. You're really good at like, okay, this isn't funny yet. But I'm dug in, and I'm keeping going. And that's something I wish I was good at. I wish I
really?
Had the resilience.
Oh, that's a kind compliment when a comic says, I wish I had that. Because I look at other comics and go, oh, I wish I had that thing. I'll never have it, but I wish
out of interest, what things? That's a question. That's like a standard question I sometimes ask is what kind of comedy powers that other people have do you wish you could?
I wish... I wish I could stay in an hour and just do my jokes. That would be good. I've seen people do it and it's quite impressive. Oop. Just stay in there. Just stay. Like I almost get bored with myself.
Okay. Go on. No, I mean, I'm interested. I'm interested in what you mean, but I don't know quite what you mean.
I don't know. It's just maybe a bit more professionalism is what I would like. Just a little bit. I don't know how to explain it. I you know what? You know what? I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, okay.
Yeah, I'm back.
Well, yeah, but part of my job as an interviewer is to resist that because I think you do know what you're talking about and I want you to articulate it. You seem very professional.
Thank you.
You seem like you're making decisions. Do you know what I mean? There are people who are all over the place and there are people who improvise in a kind of a, where's this going to go?
Right.
But you, it feels, I don't mean it feels written, but it feels deliberate.
You know what? You're right.
It's like the fact that
a friend of mine told me I got to start owning my good qualities.
Yeah.
So, because I'm always the one that's going to brush off what you just said and go, well, you know.
I'm not so great. I'm just a guy.
I am deliberate and good at that and staying in that moment. But I had to learn that, staying in the moment.
How did you learn that?
I wish I knew how I learned that.
Like, what advice would you give me if I said to you, as I have, quite honestly,
yeah.
I wish I could trust that it'll be funny at the end because I get in the moment and then I, oh God, they're not going to go for it. I'll get out of it somehow.
Why do you think you do that?
Because I have to be careful the amount I kick myself on this podcast.
Okay.
But ladies and gentlemen, I'm a good comedian. You should come and see me and spend real money. But what I'm doing is I'm opening up so that Mark will open up. And I'm doing that for you.
I'm looking
at the recorder. Yeah. I just realized.
You're looking at the recorder.
I'm doing
like
an
they're...
aside to a small black box on a table. To answer your question... I think I can't remember what the question was. This is very rare that
why when you get into that sweet spot, because you know it's a sweet spot when you have their attention and they're quiet.
The sweet spot that I recognize is when they're giggling because I'm like, the ball is in the air and I've right. got it and it's all good. I know that sweet spot,
right.
but the sweet spot when they're quiet, I have too many voices in my head. That's when the dissenting voices become a chorus of like, you're dying, get out, you're dying.
But how many human beings do you know? Lots. And how many times are they quiet? Never. If you have an entire room that's quiet, they are listening. They're not tuned out.
That is a really valuable
right?
piece of knowledge, yeah.
If you have a room that is quiet, they are waiting for you, in my opinion. I always have to downplay my own point, but that's what I felt. That's where I learned it. I was like, wait a minute, they're not talking, they're not shuffling, they're quiet. I can live in this, and it's okay. And everything doesn't have to be a big laugh. There was a time I watched a comic, and I won't say his name, but I watched him, and he went from hour to hour. He did a whole hour, and the whole room was laughing and uproariously laughing. And I remember sitting there watching going, I don't want that. I don't want that. And so I learned from that. That I like the quiet. I like the pauses. I like the moments. I like the bring them down for a bit. Bring them back up. Live in that quiet. It's good. It's a good place.
That's great, man. I'm just being quiet so I can, I'll just put a little sting in there because that's a...
No, yeah, because you're driving the bus. You're in control. Don't let them take you out of that. Stay in there. What's going to happen if you don't? You're going to feel like shit after. It's weird that we as comedians will make the decision that we'll feel crappy about after instead of, you know what, I'm proud of myself for staying there and not bailing.
Yeah. Yeah, I could do with a bit more of that. I could do with a bit more of that kind of understanding of it, of just like, yeah. it's fine.
Mm-hmm. You know what
I mean? And I'm proud of myself for doing this. I'm like a little worm. I'm like, please shine the torch on me and I will wiggle. Do you know what I mean? That's what I'm like. That's the danger, is that I'm so dependent on I'm over dependent on them laughing to make it okay.
Right.
And actually I am learning and need to learn that it's you know what I mean? I'm worth being watched.
Yes, that's huge. That's huge. That's okay to feel I'm worth being watched, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am too fucking deferent on stage and when interviewing everyone. Do you know what I mean? I really am. If I do that thing as
do
well.
Do you take any of these realizations and try to apply one a night?
When you say these from
yeah, like these yeah, like these little nuances, these little things where you're like, I want to do that.
I do, not all the time. And they're not always kind of revelatory. I suppose there's a lot of, you know, comedy's so different. Everyone I speak to brings a whole other tapestry sort of to it.
Yeah.
And often, I'm interested in going, I wonder how that would be for me. Specifically what we're talking about, I do recognize as a thing that I will try and apply.
Yeah. Living it. And then living it a bit longer.
Man, there's, I don't know if you know Al Murray,
no,
British comedian.
Yes, I think I do know Al Murray.
Character called the Pub Landlord.
Yes, yes, I know Al. Yes, comic. Yes, yes.
I heard secondhand some advice that he said, which is his favorite advice to give newer comics, is slow down. And then when you think you've slowed down too much, slow down
again. Yeah. And that makes sense.
Oh, man. I move so fast on stage. I'm trying to get all the stuff out. Yeah, that bit's good, right? And this bit's good, right? Yeah, yeah. And that thing I thought of that I thought was funny, you think is funny. Yeah. You know, and actually, I mean, presumably the writing would be take half the time. I'd need just 50% fewer jokes if I went a bit slower.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even the great fast-talking comedians are actually talking slower than we think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, living in that pause is probably one of my favorite things. It became one of my favorite things. Living in a pause where they don't know what's happening and they're quiet, to me, is more enjoyable than a laugh right now. Especially because I have a couple bits where I know I'm gonna walk them so far for such a dumb punchline.
That is such a beautiful way of putting what I was talking about. Absolutely, I'm gonna walk them. Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
So which current bit do you get to walk them the furthest?
Where I walk them the furthest is a bit about 9/11. It's a bit about how they were building the monument and it wasn't going to be ready on time. And then I was reading this article about it. And then, yeah, and then three paragraphs in, they recapped what happened on 9/11. And I was like, well, who needed that recap? That's where the joke started.
Yeah.
But I took it to the editor going into the writer. And then there's this huge long...
They're like arguing over who's supposed to have gotten the job of being editor.
Yeah, and it should have been an editor. And the one guy had been sick for 6 months. And if he'd been in the office and yada, yada, he leaves work angry, gets told to leave, goes to the bar, has a drink, has interactions with everyone at the bar. You know, he gets into a discussion about why ghosts wear clothing. Like, it's such a walk. And the end is, you know, he gets home to his wife and she's like, you know, where have you been? And he's like, I got into a fight at work about 9/11. She's like, 9 of what?
Yeah, such right? a strong punchline. Great. So that, when you know that the resolving punchline is 100% concrete, then you get to walk them and walk
you
them.
You get
and
walk to walk them. And walk and walk them. And the great thing about that one is like, the more they're into the fuckery of it, the more they're into the playfulness. You can just... Yeah. Keep just adding on to the walk.
This is just reminding me. I did a car journey once with a British comic called Jimmy McGee.
Yeah,
and he and I were in the car for I'm just coming back from some gig, and we were taking it in turns to tell the beekeeper's joke to each other. You know the beekeeper's joke?
No.
In brief, it can't really be told in brief, but basically, it's three beekeepers meet in a bar. They're having a conversation about how many bees they've got. And they mention a various number of hives, various number of bees per hive. And then they say to the third one, how many bees have you got? And he says, oh, millions of bees. How many hives? Just one. Isn't that a bit cruel? And he goes, ah, fuck them. Like, that's it. He actually, I butchered it there because it takes, you know, the joy is in the telling.
The joy is in the telling.
We took it in turns to tell the bee joke. We just ended up taking, it wasn't like an exercise. We're taking in turns to say the joke to each other, embellishing it further and further and further until the bee conference is in town. And that's why they take, you know, and it's called Pollen 2015.
But that's a huge, great exercise. How many?
It actually really was.
How many jokes do you have that you didn't walk? You know what I mean? Like, you can say, you know, when you're sitting watching a comic and you're like, that was such a small idea and you walked it for 15 minutes, like, and you go, oh man, I have jokes that I know I've written and I haven't spent enough time living in them.
Yeah.
And I need to expand them. Yeah. Because you're writing and you go, oh, well, that worked and that worked and that worked and the punchline was good. Great. I'll live in that and I'll move on to the next one.
Whereas actually that kind of the elasticity of a joke where you go, it like I tend to think of it like if I come up with a bit and it's got a really good punchline, the way I will approach it is I'll think, great, now I've got, you know, while I'm writing, I'll go, now I've got that punchline. I can slot more jokes in on the way.
Yeah.
But I don't tend to think of it in the way that, like, now that I've got a good punchline, I can spend more time getting there and discovering things.
Yes.
That to me is, that's kind of comedy wisdom. Do you know what I mean? To go, no, look at the... That's... Zen is a lazy way to describe it. But that's like kind of comedy, kung fu, feel the breath.
Right.
Because I think I focus a lot... I've got a very analytical brain, I guess, why I do this.
Right.
And I think I overanalyze comedy. And I go, how can I make this work? How can I sit down with a pen and paper and fit that thing into this thing?
Right.
And the best bits of my act are always the bits where I'm just kind of being on stage and living in it and enjoying it and the rest of it.
Yeah.
And you would have thought by now I would have learned to put down the fucking pen and paper.
Yeah, but we're morons that way.
Yeah.
We're morons that we don't, we know we have a process. We try to artificially impose another process. I've sat down to try to write and I'm like, this is not how your stuff comes to you. Why are you why are you doing it? Mm. Like, because I think sometimes we're like, well, I'm not doing enough and I'm not doing this. And blah, blah, blah. So now I just go for a walk. That's what I do. It's all about walking with me, apparently.
Okay.
This is the title of my new album. Let's go for a walk. Hey, that's very good.
It's all right. So you go for a walk when you're writing, in commas. You go for a walk, think about stuff.
Yeah. Like, I don't think I've ever written a joke down.
You've never written a joke down?
I don't think so, no. I don't think I've actually physically wrote a joke down. So I find it very strange when I come to like festivals like this, and they're like, we need to, your joke written down.
Oh, yeah, we've
down.
Got to see your...
Yeah. And especially because I was doing a joke like where I was playing like three characters, and I was like writing basically a script and sending it to them. They must have been like, well, what the... Who's Brian and Cheryl and... But, yeah, I don't think I've ever written a joke down.
I think the reason I write jokes down is to feel like I'm doing work. I made a big discovery like 2 years ago. I said, no more laptop, no more.
Okay.
No more trying to write stuff, because I then hours that I consider to be writing time are actually just cutting and pasting and moving. There's a funny idea there, and I've written some, I've kind of tried to write around the subject, pull more out of
it. It's all busy work.
And yes, busy work. That is exactly the case. Yeah, there's an awful lot of business.
And you go, well, I worked today.
Yeah.
Yeah. But honestly, the jokes you've written and the jokes you do, you've written in your head, then you've tried them, then you've reworked them based on what you did, and then you go up and try it again. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there are people that write them down, but I never got into that world. It's funny, we're sitting here talking about comedy, and I can see in the mirror... Two guys going up, cleaning windows. Very, very high up. Right.
I mean, that looks like quite fun, though.
Do you think
probably day one's quite fun?
Yeah, and then it's...
Then it's just day 30. It's really boring, and you might die.
And you might die. Yeah.
There's comedy. There we go. We're right back there.
Do you think they have a podcast?
Scrapers.
Talking about the in and out.
Hashtag scrapers. So what? Yeah. Oh, do you know what I really like is how satisfying it is when you get a scraper on a window, when you see someone, anything where you're watching someone do a thing with their hands.
Right.
That they've done a million times, like wrapping chips.
Right.
In paper.
Did you say you really enjoy that?
I genuinely enjoy watching people do a thing. Yeah, it's fascinating when you see someone. I used to be a juggler, and that's why you...
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. When that's...
Wait, you have to give up juggling?
You're right. I said I used to be. That's quite
a
way to put it.
Still a juggler.
I am. I'm just way less good.
Right. But you could juggle if asked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, mate. You'll see my whole body language changes.
Yeah, you turn into a cocky juggler.
I mean, I was good. I was so good that even now, I'm pretty good.
Did you start that way?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah.
Street performing, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So were you doing Edinburgh as a street performer?
Yes, for years. This is my 22nd festival coming up.
Because
I discovered Edinburgh when I was 16 and did street shows at it every year for like 10
years. That's amazing.
Thanks. Not enough people take that point of view.
I think it is
amazing.
I think that's brilliant.
Absolutely love it.
You should
absolutely
be proud of that.
The only thing is I can never go back to it because my show, although elements of it were creative and improvised, all the rest of it, there's so much generic / stolen material on the street because it's so hard to get an edge. It's so hard to pull off a street show.
Right.
And you can get away with it. Everyone nicks from everyone else. And I just, my show now would be ashes in my mouth. I'd do it and I'd go, oh, I convinced myself that bit was my take on a subject. And actually it was just someone else's joke with the words changed.
Really? So there's a lot of stealing in that world?
Yeah. Well, you know how much there is within the world of emceeing.
Yeah.
It's like
that
times a million.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I think it's for the same reasons. I think MCs and hosts, because you have the weight of the night on your shoulders, you want it to work for everyone. Right. It is less frowned upon to go to use more stock kind of line.
Right, right.
And yeah, I think in street performing, because the simple, like turning pedestrians into a crowd is so fucking hard.
It would be impossible.
Like, everyone just gives you kind of a... You know, a break in terms of the structures that you...
Yeah, okay.
You ate.
Wow. That's great. How long did you do that?
like 10 years.
Is this my podcast now?
Yeah, it is, yeah. About 10 years. I may take this stuff out because they've heard me talk a lot about street clothes. Oh. Although the MC point, I think, was a good point. I'm slightly concerned it's become clear that I've had some wine.
No, not at all.
Right. Are you happy?
Oh, man, what is this? This comes in at the...
It's a 50-minute mark. We're 10 minutes late for when I would normally ask this question.
Comedically?
First, comedically.
Because I probably won't answer personally.
Okay. That is an answer.
No, just because I'm pretty... Yeah. Comedically, it's like a roller coaster, right? Wednesday night, I was at a real introspective point. I was standing with David Cross. Do you know David Cross mm-hmm. from Mystery Show? And Maria Bamford mm-hmm. and Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall. And I was talking to them because I was on the show with them.
With Nish as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was on that show, and I'm not name dropping. I'm just trying to make a story. So I was standing with them and had one of those real surreal moments of like, okay, I have parts of my comedy because of you, and now I'm getting to talk to you, and you're not only talking to me because you have to, you're also talking to me because we're on the same team. So I had one of those kind of like, this is really good. I'm trying really hard to not be one of those comics anymore that's always worried about the next thing, which we all do. And so I was living in that moment. The next night, I kind of slipped into a...
What does that mean?
That's like a...
I haven't got as much as I want.
Yeah, or like, you know, I killed last night. Why am I on this shit thing?
Yep.
Right? Why is that not paying off? Right? Ran into a guy out of nowhere. It was like a guardian angel. I don't know who he was. He told me to harness my weapon. It was the greatest advice I've ever heard.
To harness your weapon?
Yeah, he goes, you have a fucking weapon. You have a smart mind. You are, it came out of nowhere. He said, yeah, all you need to do is harness your fucking weapon.
What does that mean? What do you take to mean from that?
He was saying, like, he was saying, there's the pack that, you know, they get their little things and they get their stuff. You're the guy at the back who's going to take a bit more time. Mm-hmm. And once you do come out, you're going to surpass all those people anyway. And I didn't know this guy.
He saw
me have a conversation. He saw some of my stand up and he said, and he came over and wanted to make sure like he saw something in me. That he needed to go, you need to harness your fucking weapon and don't worry about everything else. It was so weird.
I'm trying hard not to go, oh, that's the harness your weapon guy. Have you not met him before? He hangs out in the...
He just walks up to everyone.
Just a different piece of esoteric advice. You need to climb your mountain. Okay, bye. I'm out.
No, yeah. He had other specific points. Sure. But
what we're talking about here is that you, in terms of professional or creative fulfillment, you can be one night on a bill with people and go, holy shit, these are kind of my peers now. Mm-hmm. My heroes have become my peers. That's a great thing about comedy.
That's a really cool thing. I had a friend say, how many more of your heroes have to say you're okay at this before you shut the fuck up?
That's a wonderful sentiment.
Yeah.
That's a tattoo, or at the very least a cross stitch.
Yeah. And that one really hit home too. Like, yeah, how many have to say you're good at it? What does the rest matter?
Do you ever think, I sometimes find that people like us,
mm-hmm.
by which I mean people who are making a living from comedy, mm-hmm. who are, have some degree of creative satisfaction, who rightly or wrongly consider themselves not just another road act.
Oh, I thought you were going to say handsome, skinny, skinny men.
Well, let's throw that in.
Well, it's radio. Right? Like a, let me fill you up there.
Thanks, man.
I think I've drank most of that.
People, it's in those glasses. I'm wise to your tale of woe. But yeah. Podcasts are coming around, better get some empty glasses and fill them next to my bed. People like us, I find, or people who are in, you've been going longer than me, you have a higher profile than me, but...
I don't think that's true.
I think it's largely true, but okay. let's not do whatever the opposite of sucking each other's dicks is. Let's not bonk each other's dicks on the end with a cold spoon just yet. but I think comics, broadly speaking, in our demographic of comics, sometimes we have to come up with... aphorisms about how actually my road is the better one because I'm, you know, I haven't had it all handed to me.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? We have things with which we comfort ourselves, right? Like my favorite one is a comic called Simon Munnery, British comic. Mm-hmm. And I think he's wonderful. And he said years ago of comedy, it's not a race, it's a dance.
That's nice.
That kept me going for like 5 years. That was like, oh, that's so good. It's not a... This competition that I'm sensing, that I'm plugging myself into, is absolutely an illusion. It doesn't exist.
No.
Awards don't exist. The industry doesn't exist. It's not a race. It's a dance. That really, for me, that really, like, oh, yeah, absolutely. I wonder whether, and I'm just, this is an open question. I don't know what the answer is. But I wonder whether the guys who are on TV loads and have loads of money, maybe they don't need to say shit like that to themselves. Maybe they say, yep, it's a race and I won it.
Yeah, you know what? That's not a question, but I agree. Yeah, like, yeah, like, what are they thinking?
Well, I hope that they are... thinking the same things as we're thinking, but just not letting on. Because these days, when you're a comedy star,
yeah.
When you're Kevin Hart, when you're Louis,
yeah.
Probably when you get to the you know, that kind of level, and maybe less so Louis, because he is someone who you go, no, you've been fucking working for 30
yeah,
years. You know?
Yeah.
So maybe, but the kind of, you know, the big explosive sort of stars. I wonder whether part and parcel of being a star is having to pretend you have no weakness.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I guess we're living in a place where it's okay if we weep publicly. No one cares. No one cares if we're doing good. No one cares if we're crying in an alley. I don't know. I don't know. I think the next transition of my life... comedically, is going to be trying to let go of needing verification that what I'm doing is good.
Yeah,
I think that's the next step for me. Because a friend of mine said, like, if you were doing what you're doing in a bubble and no one... There was no review. There was no thing. There was no. Does that mean what you're doing isn't good? And I was like, oh yeah. Well, I guess. Yeah, I just have to think what I'm doing is good and
yeah,
and do it.
That's a really
that's a hard thing to let
nice,
go of.
Kind of metric, is that the right word? I don't know, but the idea to like, oh, imagine reviews and money didn't exist.
Yeah,
are you happy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, my God, of course I am.
Yeah, like what are we searching for? It's an unattainable goal.
Yes,
it's
okay.
A curse, and it's an unattainable goal to even try to catch it.
So, do you think that the I don't want to put words in your mouth, but this is a pet theory of mine. Tell me what you think about it.
Okay,
I think sometimes that the isolation of comedy,
uh-huh.
that the hours on the road, and the constant up and down. emotional state of killing it one night and, you know, and the next 20 nights and then having that one dodgy night, you know, the fact that it is, you know, no matter how good you are, your personal satisfaction with a show will one night be off the scale. And then even if you did well, the next night you go, ah, fucking shit. I have a theory sometimes that's the price you pay for getting to be connected to the infinite, you know, for getting to be an artist, for getting to be someone who doesn't deal in numbers on a balance sheet,
yeah,
and definite things and concrete material. This is how it is. We get to deal with the ethereal. We get to go, oh, that was potentially life changing, and that wasn't.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Because sometimes I think
that's a good theory.
When you're having a shit time of it and you're lonely, that's the price you pay. And then every so often I meet happy comedians. And I do think they exist. I think people can have funny bones and still be happy.
Yeah.
And I think they would laugh at that theory and say, no, that's ridiculous. That's you being sort of up and down emotionally. Yeah, I think, funny, but I think you can have good, happy comedians.
Yeah.
I can't name five, but I'm sure they're just, it's a numbers game. It's got to be possible.
Yeah, I think that's a really good theory.
Is the price you pay worth it?
Yeah. I'm sure like a coal miner listening to this would be like, what price are you paying?
Use a coal miner all the time as an example, but in all honesty, I'm sure you're the same. I've been told by a fighter pilot that I'm brave. Yeah? So, yeah, we're not getting scabs and sores and whatever other coal miner shit I don't know about and have just made up, but we are putting our dignity on the line.
Why are they getting scabs?
Well, because their boots rub.
Maybe blisters. Yeah, I don't know about scabs.
I think I meant blisters. From their knees, you know. They forgot to take the little coal miner's knee pad like a little gardening old lady has.
They're picking their wounds at night.
They've got all coal dust in them.
But I know what you're saying.
It's work and you're at risk. You put your dignity at stake. You put that on the line, and that's something very brave, hardworking, industrious people don't necessarily want to do.
Yeah, you know what? You've got me on both sides of this argument. I don't know where I'm standing anymore.
I can't remember the point I'm making.
Yeah, no, I don't know where I'm standing on it anymore. Yeah, I guess maybe I'm discounting how hard it is what we do because I'm... that's a good question. I don't know. you know what? I'm going to do my thing. I don't know. I really don't. It's a hard job. I'd say 80% of it is work. 80% of it is work. And then you get these highlights that maybe the general public sees or your friends see or things and then go, oh, you're living the dream there. And it's like, yeah, well, you didn't see me at the hotel in a small town wherever, you know, looking at YouTube videos just because I wanted to fucking bawl my eyes out. Like, it is an emotionally hard thing. I think most comics probably could cry at the drop of a hat. They won't admit it because they're all tougher than that. But it's
because comedy's part of the armor. The armor, isn't it? Comedy's part of the... No, I'm fine. I'm a comedian.
Yeah,
I think that I see a lot of that in comedy, and it's absolutely true of my own life.
Yeah,
whatever problems I had before, well, at least now I'm a comedian. I've got the thing.
Yeah,
even if I'm a shit one.
Yeah,
which again, I'm not. But even if I am, I am the thing, and that's special. And it's a huge part of my identity in a way that I think drives my partner up the wall because, you know, I do see it as a vocation and a calling, and it's my thing. And I think really, although one way of looking at it, those are all true. Another way of looking at it, no, that's what you tell yourself when you're terrified of the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. Like imagine Monday going in and checking a schedule of when you have to work. Like that's terrifying to me. I don't know if we're just being delusional or creating something or... Yeah, that's a good one. I don't know.
You wore a cardigan when you went and did that Craig Ferguson set.
Yeah.
God damn it, I respect the hell out of you for that. I've never seen any other comedian do a set on a TV show, like a late night TV show, wearing a red cardigan.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. That's you to a T.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, well, whenever we do these galas here, they're like, bring two outfits and all that stuff. I bring one.
Yeah.
We call them hoodies here.
Yeah, yeah, we call them hoodies. Yeah.
Yeah, so I bring
it's
one.
It's a nice clean hoodie.
Yeah.
The white strings are clearly been clean.
I bring one hoodie and say, this is my outfit. Like, take it or leave it. Because that's the one snobby thing I am about comedy. I don't understand when I see a comedian worrying about what shoes they're going to wear. And I get you want to look nice. I really do. But I also go, why aren't you just worrying about the jokes? Why are you worrying about the shoes? And the more I find that the people worry about the shoes and the thing and the jacket and, like, does my jacket look good? And does this look good? It's like, are you overcompensating for the fact that your jokes aren't ready? Oh, then you can't see the face I made.
It was a regretful. It was a record show. It was, oh God, I've said too much.
Well, I tell you what, I totally agree with you, and yet I also worry about my shoes. And I think if I was put on the spot, I would say,
but if it makes you comfortable, I'm okay. But
no, it doesn't. The whole thing makes me uncomfortable, and I do, because I know in my belly it doesn't fucking matter what shoes I wear. I'm trying to throw salt in over my shoulder. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to go, like, I just don't want it to be my shoes that fuck me up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I see. You're teaching me another side of it.
But I agree with you. I don't agree with my thing. I'm weak. I'm pathetic. And I'm worrying about my shoes. And not only am I worrying about them, I'm getting myself in a right fucking state about them. I did a taping last year, and it's online, and I'm wearing a blue blazer and a yellow t-shirt. And I fucking hate it. And I talked myself into that being a good idea, and it isn't what I wanted to wear.
So maybe the next time, just don't even have the conversation.
Yeah. That's a solution.
I don't know. I get mocked a bit for what I wear on stage, and I get complimented for what I wear on stage. But I just wanted to always be in something comfortable, and I also didn't give two flying fucks what I was wearing. I really didn't. I really don't. I just want my jokes to be good. So maybe I'm a buffoon, an idiot. You know, maybe the industry is like, well, look at this fucking slob. But I'm a true believer that the work is what matters. I made that face again. But I can't say I'm a true believer in it and then make that face. So I'm going to say it again, even just for me. But I'm a true believer that the work is all that matters. I think if you're being great up there, who fucking cares what fucking shoes I'm wearing?
Absolutely. I think once someone's great, they can decide to wear whatever they want.
Yeah.
And then people, idiots, will watch it and go, oh, he's great because he's wearing a suit. Like, apparently, Louis C.K. was on last night at this festival.
Yeah.
And he was wearing a suit. And everyone was like, oh, Louis in a suit. That's sort of interesting. You know, and you go, oh, well, we're doing suits now. You know, everyone will start wearing a suit now.
Now everybody's going to be wearing a fucking suit.
Yeah, but it's not the suit, is it?
No, it's not the suit. He's just really good at what he does, and he works hard, and his jokes are well-crafted and funny. He was wearing a T-shirt that was probably $2 when he started. Like,
what would you have for your career if everything worked out exactly as you wanted it? Where would you like to, I don't just mean like, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time, but what is the perfect comedy career look like for you?
My bills are paid, there's food on the table, and I'm performing for people that want to see me perform. Not just, what do you guys call them over there? I learned it last year. What do you call people that come? I love
punters. Yeah, I love that
one. That was the greatest thing I think
who's
I ever...
this fucking punter? Yeah. Like, it's so dismissive, but it isn't at all. But it just, it just has 1% disdain.
Yeah, it's so great that you call them punters.
Like when you meet someone... Do you have this of meeting someone at a party and describing them as a random?
Like, no.
We met a couple of randoms last night and they came back with us. I love it. And then, so this was a thing in the UK. People still probably do it every so often. But when you meet someone at a party who then describes themselves as a random, I love it. Don't worry about me. I'm just a random.
Just a random.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's kind of... there's a kind of freedom to that kind of human being.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you ever feel like as a comedian, it's a bit of a curse? Like what if you could remove, if you could remove the drive that makes you continue doing this,
mm-hmm. you might be happier.
Yeah, like, would you? I don't know.
Well, I wouldn't, because I've seen enough sci-fi that I know if you start mucking around with things, then you end up fucking your own granddad.
Oh, man.
In a time travel way.
Well, he was a handsome man. he took care of himself. He probably wouldn't want me.
That's... I should ring a bell whenever anyone says something quintessentially themselves. But... Yeah, you could remove the drive and just have a life that wasn't like this.
Yeah, like my...
Like consistency.
Yeah.
Wouldn't consistency be interesting?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I'd be happy either.
No, it wouldn't. It would be boring.
But you don't have the drive. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't have that mindset. God. So you,
that's like, do you ever see that film Dark Man?
Yes.
It's like Sam Raimi film, and it's what's his name? Liam Neeson, isn't it? And
yes.
He cut his pain receptors, and so he becomes a superhero with no pain. Kind of early Kick-Ass, but kind of much darker. Great film. You could do that, but for drive.
Yeah, just cut the drive. Because you're not sitting at the desk 9 to 5 going, yeah, but I wish I would. No, that's gone. That's just, I go to work, I like this job, it's fine. Yeah, and then I go
it's
home.
Fine. And then I remember as a kid thinking, oh, you can either be an interesting creative person or a suit.
Yeah.
Those are your two choices. And that's absolutely nonsense.
No, those human beings are...
Those are human beings! They're 99% of all human beings.
Yeah.
They windsurf. They fucking do great... You know, that was my go-to for like an interesting thing to do at weekends. I think I meant surf, but windsurf came out.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, these suits, some of them windsurf. You know, they do interesting shit.
If things are going well, you're windsurfing. That's great. I've never windsurfed, so that's probably why my career's in the shitter. I gotta buy a windsurfer. Are they called windsurfers?
I don't know.
Okay.
No one email in. Get out of that gold. Which bit of someone else's stuff do you most covet?
The joke I think I like the most was Stuart Francis. What if dolphins don't want to swim with retarded kids?
I feel bad. I don't know about the word. We don't use that word.
We don't use it.
Americans seem to be totally fine with using that word.
We don't use it either.
I have just laughed at a guilty wave, so you got me.
But it's just a great concept. And another joke was of Winston Spears. He's a Canadian comic, and he made a joke about a horse that was amongst cows. So he would look at the cows and go, I'm the fastest cow. So those two things were kind of like the things I went, yeah.
Do you, that's interesting.
But then everyone else's career, I would like.
Okay. But it's interesting. Those two examples are both sort of one-liners.
I know.
And that's not the sort of thing that you do.
That I do.
I have a similar relationship to this comic, Simon Munnery, who does the most wonderful, wise, profound one-liners. And he was why I wanted to be a comedian. And I thought as a younger person that I would somehow end up like him because he was my favorite. And I could not be a million times more different.
Yeah. No, like Mitch Hedberg was a big influence of mine. Zach Galifianakis was a big influence. Stuart Francis. Like those guys were guys I was like, oh, I really like how intelligent what they're doing is.
And you do have one-liners, but you hide them on the album by doing a guitar. You do a guitar.
Exactly.
You play a guitar to cover the fact that you're doing some one-liners.
Yeah. It's weird. If you separate that album, I'm actually like three different kinds of comedian. Like, I got some one-liners in there. I got some rants in there. I got some stuff that's sort of about the world. And then I have these weird stories. And it's funny because I'll do like these gals and stuff, and 1 year I'll be that these different things. So it's it might be, I don't know, maybe it's a shooting myself in the foot, but I kind of like it all.
Comedy does tend to reward people who do one thing.
Yeah. Ah, you put a bow tie on. Give them a series.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's
but
easier
to simplify it, but yeah.
It's to you become a more marketable asset.
Yeah.
If you are, if they go, oh, he's that guy that does that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you watch my hour, which you did, you don't go, well, I don't know who he was or what he was doing.
Yeah.
It all makes sense. I don't know. Maybe I should just jump out that window. How does an interview go from that? Anyway, imagine I jumped out the window. I think your podcast would get a lot of hits.
I know, man, but these windows don't open. And that is...
I'm a fat guy. I could smash.
With enough of a run-up.
I could smash that.
Well, I mean, I've got to be honest. A tiny part of me wants to see you try only to hit it and be fine, because that would be a funny thing to see. But I wouldn't. I don't want. This is probably why I'm not the best comic I could be, because for me, the jeopardy of you potentially crashing through it is enough that I don't want you to try.
Oh, shit. No, we are more similar than you think, because in public school, there was a guy named Steve Marsh. I mean, we were standing at the end of a long hallway, and he said, hey, do you want to see me run and try to smash my head through that window at the end of the hall? And I was like, yes, sir, I would like to see that.
Did he make it?
No, he did it. But he didn't smash the window. It kind of cracked, and then he was really hurt.
By public school, do you mean?
That would be like grade 1 to 5.
Okay. Public school in the UK means fee paying.
What does that mean?
Like, you know, your parents pay money to send you to school. It's the opposite of what public should mean. When you the moment's gone, so you might not remember. Yeah. But a moment ago when you said, I think I'm just going to jump out the window.
Yeah.
What was that impulse?
That's the I'm not good enough impulse. That's the, which we talked about earlier as well. It's the, I look at you, I look at your mic, I look at the recorder, I look at the whole situation. I look that you saw my show in Edinburgh, and I go, yeah, I'm not worth this. I don't know why this human being is here. And it all goes that rapidly, and then I'm like, I should just jump out that window. It's the same when I'm sitting at the bar alone, when the crowd is buzzing around me. That brain goes so fast that I don't know how to slow it down sometimes. Yeah, when I'm on stage, I can take my pauses, but it's that sitting at that table, it becomes no one likes me, no one respects me. Why are you here? Then it quickly turns to these people are all looking at me thinking I'm some sort of big shot sitting alone. So it quickly turns from I'm not good enough to, oh, now they're thinking I'm a big shot. Now I'm this, I'm that. I'm out of there. Jump out the window.
So do you recognize on some level that those...
That's
thoughts.
Insane.
Well, I'm not going to use that language. I'm going to use this language. Those thoughts are kind of like what a therapist would call kind of cognitive errors. Like those things are, they're not helping you. They're not accurate.
Oh.
Actually, there's a whole like, that's a kind of a charted, you can buy books and fucking graphs which explain why people think in those kind of spirals and how not to.
Yeah. I mean, I went to therapy and it was a great thing. You know, I learned to say stop and all that stuff. But, every day is not a great day.
Did it pull the plug on this line of questioning whenever you want? I've done a lot of therapy. I talk about it a lot on the podcast. And there's an odd thing. I've done a lot of therapy. That sounds like a boast. The world's worst boast. I am fucking good at getting therapized. But I...
You know what? You haven't been to the therapy I've been to.
That is 100%. Yeah.
You don't know therapy, yeah. Bud.
Do you feel that it worked, the therapy that you did?
Yeah. Well, the thing was, when I was a young man, I would have been the guy that would have mocked the person going to therapy. I was that, and I hate that I was that. When I did go to therapy, it was hard, and it took me a while. Especially as a comedian, I found it took me a bunch of sessions to realize that I don't have to impress this person, and they don't give two flying fucks who I am or what I'm doing. So to break that barrier was great. And then just be able to go, oh, they're just doing their job, and I get to talk, and I get to sort through what's going on in my head. I think every human should go to a therapist, even if you're fine.
I agree with you, but at the same time, I think if I was fine, I absolutely wouldn't want to risk putting myself like wobbling. You know what I mean?
So if you're fine, you don't want to go like, oh, I don't want to know
because I might be not fine. Be fine.
Yeah, I get that. But I know, I think there's a lot of people out there that probably could use it. It's not the thing that it's not the stigma that it obviously was.
Sure.
It's more an open thing now. But yeah, it's a great thing because we're not talking to each other
but
properly.
If it had worked for you, then presumably you wouldn't be feeling those people swirling around you kind of thing.
No, but I know how to deal with them better than I used to.
Yes.
Okay. I would sit in it more. I would stay there more. In the old days, I would live in it more. I'd hate myself more. Now I at least know I need to stop this behavior, so I leave.
In the same way as I often would say to someone, what piece of advice could you give a new comic to make them the best? Right. What piece of advice would you give someone? Like, what one bit from therapy have you thought, oh, that's the bit that I'd pass on to someone? That's the...
It was the cycle, the way the brain cycles. And then you get caught in that. I want to use the right words. Repetition, and the anxiety is growing, and you're going over and over and over and over and over and over in your brain, and then all of a sudden you're in a horrible state of mind. What she taught me was to recognize when that is starting, and go do something else. That was the hugest amount of advice to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't fix you. It doesn't solve everything, but to go do something else instead of living in that was huge for me.
Because actually recognizing that you have the option to not just keep living in it.
You don't have to live in it.
I'm busy thinking this stuff, so I better keep thinking this stuff.
And I know exactly where it's going to end. And I know exactly where it's going to take me. Why do I keep going there? And it was to just go do anything. Go anything. Anything. As soon as you recognize it's happening, go do anything else. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's probably hundreds and hundreds of human beings. Thousands. What am I doing? Thousands of human beings.
I'm
sorry my math was off.
There's at least six other humans.
But there's, like, lots of people that lie in bed. Like, I equate it to this. There's lots of people that lie in bed and are like, why am I not falling asleep? Why am I not falling asleep?
Yeah.
I'm not falling asleep. Get up. Go do something else. You're awake. Go do it. Go do anything else. That's what I equate it to. Just go do something else. Why waste your time being awake in a moment where you're forcing yourself to live in a place you don't want to be? Go do something else.
That's good advice. So to finish there, to wrap up,
yeah.
What would be the equivalent in comedy terms? What, like, specifically, I don't mean like a general blanket piece of advice to new acts.
Right.
In terms of the lesson that has learned, the lesson that has made the most difference to you, what could you pass on that was like, this is, I'm formulating an idea now for a question which I might reuse in future, but it's almost like if you came back from comedy and said, guys, this is the one thing I learned.
Right. Where was I, by the way?
I don't. I'm imagining some sort of mission to comedy, where comedy is a planet, and you went there and you went through your comedy career, and then you had to leave that planet and return and go, whoa, okay, well, I tell you what, the one thing you've got to know is this.
Has everyone aged?
No, it is an interstellar type situation where your time didn't move for anyone else. In fact, if anything, you've aged. Oh, they haven't.
Shit, I'm at the end.
No, you've only aged by 3 years. You've got loads of time.
Shit, I had the answer. Isn't that terrible? The greatest thing I've ever learned has left my mind. That's what it was. The greatest thing I think I ever learned would be that don't try to feed the audience what you think they want. Make the audience come to you. That was the biggest thing I think I learned. Don't just be shoveling them stuff that you think they want to hear. Stop and make them go down your road instead. That's the best thing I ever learned.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
So that was Mark. A joy to listen to, a joy to talk to. Please do seek out his work online. I hope he's coming back to Edinburgh soon. If you're in the UK or if you're in Canada or somewhere else where he is, you should definitely find out more about Mark and try and get to see him live. He's such a warm and funny man. Brilliant act. Go along and check out Mark. By the time you hear this, I will already have interviewed Paul Chowdhury live at Soho Theatre on the 20th of February. And don't forget, Jeremy Hardy is my guest on the 8th of May after I come back from Oz. And Joe Brand is my guest on the 5th of June. So please go to sohotheatre.com and remember to enter the code VERA, all in capital letters, in the promo box in order to get your discount. Now, that has been wonky, apparently, and that hasn't been working. A few people mentioned that. We've got to the bottom of it, and I can confirm it now does work. Comedianscomedian.com/tour for all the information on my show, and I hope you come and see me somewhere soon. There is Who's Next Week? Next week will be Paul Chowdhury released, and the week after that will be episode 200. 200! The double ton! The duo century! It's a mystery guest. Some of you guessed it on the Facebook group. Others of you I've told in person in little Q&A things after the tour show. I'm really excited. I've done a whole ton of research, and I think we have had to reschedule the interview to be a week later, which may mean there is a brief hiatus. I'll try and fill it if I can. But it's absolutely going to be worth waiting for. Can't wait for that. So, that's all of that. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Daryl. Thanks to Matt Hoss, who logged this episode, and Emily Crosby and Livy Phipps, who tend to log all the others for me. That's all the people I need to thank. Thanks to Mark Forward. Thanks to you for listening. Do like and share and subscribe and all of those sorts of things. You can leave me a review. I currently have exactly 600 reviews on the iTunes UK website. But if you're an iTunes user in a different country, your review is even more useful and worthwhile to me, because that really helps bump up the rankings on the different iTunes pages for different countries. I think that's all I'm going to ask of you. I'm going to have a little post-amble at you in a sec, which I've not prepared. So regular listeners will know that this one could be a rambler. Speak to you soon. Okay. What's been going on? Thanks to everyone. A couple of people got in touch. I sort of specifically did a don't get in touch about my granny. I will just take your condolences for granted. Thank you. I'll take them as read. A couple of people did get in touch anyway. And of course, that was very nice. Her funeral is in a couple of days. I am going to speak at the funeral. I've asked not to, but I have been asked to. I've been re-asked, so I'm going to do that. And I'm sort of looking forward to it, but I think I'm definitely going to cry. Obviously, what I'd love to do is some of my great material about her, because I think it celebrates her life in a really wonderful way. But I'm not going to do material. I'm not going to turn my granny's funeral into a gig, because I'm not a monster. So I've got to think of some things. It's quite a weird task, quite an interesting challenge it's a eulogy, isn't it? Yes, I hadn't thought about it like that. I guess it's a bit of a eulogy. It's quite an odd task to do public speaking that doesn't have to be funny. I have to kind of unlearn stuff and remember, hey, don't be doing crowd work at the funeral.
And listen, some of you will know, I've just been away supporting Jack Whitehall. That's the other huge thing that's happened recently. So in the last 7 days, I think I've performed to something like 55,000 people. Sorry, 55,099, because 99 came to Crawley. Who knew Goldsmith could sell 99 tickets in Crawley? I almost bought the 100th ticket myself on the way out, just to hit three figures. But that was very, very exciting. And the tour, oh my God, thank you to everyone that looked after me. Thanks to the tour manager, Johnny, and Benny Boy, and Mark, the sound guy, and Mike, the rigger, and Neil, the production manager, and all of those cool people that looked after me. And Jack, of course, it was really fun spending time with him. And I honestly felt like I had a good one, and then a great one, and then a fine one, and then a good one, and then a really great one. It's so much fun to properly have a gig go off in front of 10,000 people. There's so many weird things come into it. I talked about this a little bit on the live videos that still sit up on my Stuart Goldsmith Comedian fan page, if you want to track that down and chuck like on it to do nothing but salve my ego. If only 5,000 people laugh at your joke, like if only 5,000 people laugh at your joke, then you've lost half the room. Isn't that incredible? Isn't that incredible? You can see why there's a sort of, you know, I don't know that I will ever become an arena comedian. Someone did point out to me, there was in the John Robbins episode, he sort of said in passing something like, my comedy wouldn't make sense in an arena, yours wouldn't make sense in an arena. I'm pleased to tell you, my comedy made sense in an arena. But I do know what he was getting at, which is that he and I both, I think, we're interested in kind of emotional journeys and arcs and kind of texture in a story. You know, you don't necessarily want to be doing as an artist, you make a decision, don't you, about how broad are the strokes of your brush. And in order to be the sort of act, in my experience, who can absolutely consistently smash an arena gig for an hour and a half, you know, is that the direction I'm going in? I mean, it was certainly really fun to do, and I certainly, there were bits where I was like, punchline, 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 woof, roar, you know, they were really exciting. I don't know if I could keep that up for an hour and a half. I don't know if I'm that guy. I've got nothing but respect for anyone that can. I think that's an astonishing achievement. And but I suppose also the difference is when someone is playing an arena, they're playing to their crowd who are there to see them, which necessarily means that they have got a huge amount of fame. Really, I mean, I'd be staggered if you could sell an arena without being famous. So maybe the audience approach it in a different way. Maybe they approach your act because they've already bought you. You know, it's like if you do a show and you've got fans in, even at the level at which I'm working, if I do a show and I've got 20 pod fans in, you guys know me, you've bought into me, so you give me a different sort of a ride, don't you? You enjoy the show. You don't need me to go out and kill for 10 minutes to win you over. You're already won over, so that's lovely. So I imagine doing an arena to 10,000 people that have already bought into you. What a feeling that must be. I mean, it was very exciting, and I loved watching the show every night and just seeing the work that Jack was doing to take everyone with him. And when everyone is 10,000 people, it's just an astonishing challenge, and amazing to see the work and the skill that goes into something like that. I'm not afraid to say, I really bloody enjoyed it. I loved sleeping on a tour bus. I loved waking up in a new place. All of the production crew, all of the, you know, 30 or 40 people or whatever it is that travel with that show, they've all got long histories of doing rock tours for 20 or 30 years. I don't know what they must think of a show where basically a bloke walks on and does jokes. I mean, in many ways, it requires not much less in the way of organisation. I thought arenas had their own sound and stage and lights equipment. Nope, not the case. You've got to take it all with you. It's nuts. So tremendous fun doing that. And I'll remember that forever. That was a really fun thing to do. Who knows if I will ever become the sort of act that can sell an arena. It is different. There is, you know, from 10,000 people, I went to 99 the two nights later. And you know, there's a difference in terms of intimacy. There just is. There, when you're doing thousands and thousands, they're a long way from you. You do have to go more slowly to listen to the reaction, to give them time to react. And I think on the first one I did, the first Wembley Arena one, I went so slowly. I became very sort of stagey. And did I say this last time? It's been a hell of a week. I don't think I'd done it by the time I spoke to you last time, so I can't have. But I think I kind of tried to play it big deliberately and bigger and slower. And of course, you don't need to do that because you've got huge, great screens on your face. There's a camera zooming in on your face. You can actually work smaller in some ways. And the only bit where you need to slow down is to let the huge laughs kind of roll back in the room and before they fade away. So you don't kind of cut them off. You don't need to walk out there and do the entire show at half speed. I learned. But, oh God. So very, very, very happy memories of that. I'm yawning now. I'm sorry. I'm doing late gigs and getting up early with the boy. And I'm really enjoying doing the patented Goldsmith touring method. Hour-long show in the first half. Bang, that's the hour. You've got what you paid for. If you'd like to come back, bonus extra content, me working out new stuff. Feels like it shouldn't work, but it does. And it's really, I'm finding it so useful doing the new stuff, doing it that way around. I say patented Goldsmith thing. No one else is allowed to do it like this. This is my invention. I think everyone else does kind of crowd work and then new bits for the first half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever, maybe a support act interval hour show. I'm really enjoying doing it upside down. I'm sorry I'm yawning. I hope if you're driving, this doesn't make you yawn. Eyes on the road, guys. That will do us for now. I've got lots of other stuff I could tell you about, but I'm knackered and I need to prep. I'm doing Brighton tonight, and that's a drive, and then a first half and a second half and a drive back, and then it's a super busy. I've been seeing the Boutros this weekend, and it's been wonderful, and his mother, of course, who doesn't have a code name, but that's why I don't speak about her so much, because she doesn't have a code name. Talk about her a lot on stage, though. I mean, the strongest 5 minutes of the new show is me picking apart her eating habits. So I don't know. I've really got to get that stuff absolutely watertight before she sees it, or I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. Here's some other things I've been enjoying. There's a mail shot going out soon, I hope, possibly over the weekend, with some other things I've been enjoying recently. But I've just been, if you're into comic books, get a hold of The Injection by Warren Ellis. Oh my God, it's brilliant. Warren Ellis has got such great ideas. And it's just called Injection by Warren Ellis and Declan Shelvey. And I've just got the two of those on my Kindle, and it's absolutely brilliant. I'm sure I've been enjoying other stuff as well. I probably haven't. What I've been enjoying is catering from Dags and Lincoln on tour. Hey, Dagsy. Now I have to source my own food. Oh, how have the mighty fallen? That'll do for now. Thank you for listening, everybody. Hopefully, by the next time I speak to you, I will be giving you information as to where you can get the next ComCom limited edition fabulous piece of merchandise. So let's talk about that soon, and update coming soon on the mystery guest for episode 200. Speak to you next week.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.